This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, Lingitha, Noia, and Māori, and good fellow morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. We are proud to bring the show to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. On the show today, serious accusations of sexual assault within the seasonal workers scheme. And there's still confusion on who can actually vote in Samoa's elections and the vaka that waited. It's a short film on reclaiming one's cultural language. More on these stories shortly. And remember, we are across Facebook and Instagram at ABC Pacific. And we do welcome your feedback. Wherever you're tuning in from, Malo Abito, I'm Aggie Dubow, and this is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. In less than a week's time, Solomon Islands will hold its national and provincial elections. It's the biggest election in the country's history, and all eyes are on whether Prime Minister Manase Songovei will return to office for a fifth term. One person who's been travelling across the country and speaking to voters about their hopes and aspirations is our ABC reporter in Solomon Islands, Chrisnarita Almanuleong. She's joining us live this morning from Honiara. With that, I say hello and get that, Chrissy.
Good fella morning, Aggie.
Thank you for joining us. Chrissy, man, tell us about your trip across the country. Who have you been able to speak to, and where have you been?
Yes, Aggie, over the past few weeks, I've been out of Honiara. Thankfully, a lot of times the focus is on Honiara itself. But it was a rewarding experience to go out into the provinces. We went particularly to Malaita. We had the Pacific producer, Gabby, who was here, and we went out speaking to the people who were closest to the issues. And it was truly rewarding to be able to also go out into the provinces as a Solomon Islander, because many say that the truest and purest form of Solomon Islands can be experienced out of Honiara. So we got to experience that while we went out gathering news. But there were stories of many that needed to be amplified as well. And so the past 2 weeks we were out there gathering stories for the Pacific show, and that will come on an election special on ABC The Pacific later today. But it was important to speak to, you know, like you said, the people we've spoken to, everyday Solomon Islanders. We spoke to an academic, politicians. It was a bit of a struggle to get to the politicians because they were out all over across, you know, Solomon Islands doing their political campaigns. But we managed to speak to a few of them, some of the youth leaders, farmers, health workers. Gosh, we've spoken to so many people. I can't really
I was just going to say, Chrissy, that, you know, amazing work to be able to get out there and really hear the issues of the people. So I'm wondering, what have been some of those issues of concern to Solomon Islanders leading up to the election?
Well, a lot of these issues, Aggie, they're not new issues. They are ones that have been, over the years, continuously spoken about and talked about by many Solomon Islanders. So this is with youth bulge, unemployment issues, some domestic issues, lack of sanitation and water. Some of these are the basic necessities of many, you know, accessing health facilities that have medication, accessing quality education or schools that are able to cater for communities across Solomon Islands. And many have also spoken about inefficient, the issues are inefficient transport services, shipping services. So quite a lot of issues that we've gauged from the conversations that we've had with many Solomon Islanders. But one that remains at the very top is health. And that's health centers in provinces that are lacking basic medications. They have to travel, you know, far and across to get to National Referral Hospital, which is the only referral hospital here in Solomon Islands, and that's based in Honiara. And there's, in fact, common knowledge that even some of these hospitals, the National Referral Hospital itself, isn't adequately resourced for the high population demands that's going on in the country. So we did manage to speak to many of them, and I guess the main question that stands out from a lot that we've spoken to is, where has all the money been used? Where has the politicians used the money? And like I said, held at the very top, we will take a listen to one of the interviews that we did with one of the mothers who we met at the National Referral Hospital, and she was waiting for medication for her son's chronic stomach problem.
In terms of health, this is what we get, and it's really sad because maybe for those with money, they could afford to go to hospitals overseas. Meanwhile, for majority of us, we're stuck here. People should choose their leaders, the next members wisely. Because like, even if we choose the same people, we don't see any differences.
And we're also going to be hearing from Dr. Janella, is it? NRH Medical Superintendent?
It's stressful for our staff. Especially when you're standing in front of a patient who's dying, you know what to give, but you don't have it. We would really want to see a hospital being built in a short time, like the Pacific Games, the sports facilities. We have issues to space, and with the facility itself, it's like an old lady on a resuscitation machine, which is struggling to survive. And we deserve to have a better place to work in and not to wait for a very long time for the medicines.
And that election special, if you are tuning in, can actually be viewed on The Pacific, which is on ABC Australia tonight across the region. Chrissy, I do want to ask, what is the mood like on the ground? Are people starting to leave Honiara for their constituencies?
Aggie, I can tell you it's election fever right now in Honiara and across Solomon Islands. People that we've spoken to, even just last night when I came home, there was a rally that was, in the neighborhood. People are engaging in political analysis, their own, at the betel nut stalls. Even during school pick-up and drop-off, you'll hear parents talking about elections and politics and, who will win. But of course, when it comes to the Honiara ports, it's full to capacity. There's chaos there, many passengers, some of which I've seen, they're struggling to try and get on the next ferry out into the provinces because, as you can imagine, many of them are here in Honiara, living in Honiara, but have had to move, start to get their way across to the different constituencies across Solomon Islands, because for many, home is out of Honiara because they have their families, their wantoks, their relatives, they're connected to their land out in the different 50 constituencies outside of Honiara itself. So the absence of out-of-constituency voting has also made it challenging for many because they've had to. That means they have to go out to their provinces, and it can take a little bit of while to go out. There's variation of transport mode, even distances and the geographical locations itself. So traveling takes days, and so we've seen a lot of that happening over the past few days. Aggie, also there's been a liquor ban for a week. That itself is in the lead up to the elections, and that'll start on the 16th, a day before the election day. And also there is a public holiday on the polling day that's to allow for public servants, school students, and many Solomon Islanders to be able to take part in, not only take part, but, cast their ballot papers. Public servants have also been given the green light to travel. So, it's a great deal, and one that doesn't happen too often for us. It's after 5 years that many Solomon Islanders will be able to cast their ballot paper. So one of that, in order to get that going, that means traveling out into the provinces for some. And the most important traveling would be to cast their ballot papers next Wednesday.
I do have to ask, Chrissy, in terms of security, and we know we probably shared many stories like this on our show. In 2019, there were about 1,600 police officers that were deployed across Solomon Islands. So I'm just wondering, are we expecting an increase given the joint elections?
Absolutely, Aggie. We can expect, we are expecting the number to probably double given that it's a joint or synchronized elections. But of course, security remains a top priority, especially for these elections. people want to see a free and fair elections. And with the geographical location that, you know, Solomon Islands is in and logistical challenges, it's important for people to know and, you know that their ballot papers or their ballot boxes are of paramount safety. And unlike we've been hearing from the police commissioner and the Royal Solomon Islands Police Force that there's unlikely any tumultuous occurrence to happen. And we also do know that government has requested assistance using its current security frameworks that are in place with the Solomon Islands Assistance Forces. That's that includes Fiji, New Zealand, and Australia, as well as the Papua New Guinea's Defence Force. And we also have the Chinese Police Force, who are also on the ground. And all of them are working together for a free and fair elections. We understand from this week's press conference that the Deputy Police Commissioner have said that police deployment have begun to the provinces, and we're expecting, what she's saying is that we're expecting a paramilitary contingent from Papua New Guinea, Fiji, and Australia to replenish the local forces in Honiara itself. And in terms of Australia and New Zealand support, they will be supporting in terms of logistics, both on land, air, and sea. So it's a great thing to see all these forces coming together to work together towards this common goal, Aggie.
Thank you for that. And look, before I let you go, Chrissy, I know this has made the headlines. A lot of people have seen this. Solomon Islands Prime Minister this week, after the Organised Crime and Corruption Reporting Project and even the in-depth Solomons, have called on the PM to explain his wealth. We understand at the centre of this was that allegation that Solomon Islands built 8 homes in the past 6 years. So has there been a response from the Prime Minister?
A response from the Prime Minister himself, as you know or have heard, he's out in Choiseul Province, where his constituency is, in the lead up to the elections. But we have received a response from his wife, Madam Amy Sogavare, who has responded to the OCCRP report, saying that she was saddened that they were not contacted, or the Sogavares weren't contacted at all through during this when this story broke out. And for her, it was her and her family, it was a traumatic experience for them. And at this point in time, you know, leading up to the elections, Madam Sogavare has said it's culturally insensitive, as it might create, you know, fear and for themselves as Sogavares, but their safety is of importance leading up to the elections. And these sort of reports are culturally insensitive, and it might trigger some ill connections or feelings from people, especially when it comes to, you know, elections, and could be, you know, they possibly might do something like that again. Mm. So that's where Amy's, Madam Amy Sogavares' stand is.
Well, Chrissy, thank you so much for updating us and letting us know what is happening. Like you say, it is only less than a week, and I know we'll be keeping in touch with you very shortly. But thank you again for this morning.
Thank you, Thomas, Aggie.
No worries. And that is our ABC reporter in Solomon Islands, Chris Narita Almanuleong. Welcome back to Pacific Beat. Please be aware the following story does involve the topic of sexual assault and discretionary is advised. A Papua New Guinean community leader in Queensland is appealing to the PNG government to seriously look at the people who are being sent for seasonal work in Australia after 3 PNG farm workers were jailed for raping a young woman. Sauni Ongomeni, who lives in Townsville, says such incidents bring a bad name to Papua New Guinea, the perpetrators' families and PNG citizens living in Australia. She says some workers have been picked up by the police for drunken behaviour in entertainment areas and in public places.
Whoever they send in here has to represent Papua New Guinea, right? It's not about just their families or directly themselves. They are the ambassadors of Papua New Guinea. So whatever they do here reflects the Papua New Guinea government, Papua New Guinea people, and especially the company. I think they have companies that is approved by the government of Papua New Guinea to recruit. So the management of these companies who are recruiting is at fault if they're not selecting properly. Number two, whatever is going on between the government, the companies, the departments, who is responsible for sending these young people to Australia, has to ensure that they are interviewing them properly, right into their lifestyle, how, where they come from, how they live in the background has to be checked and rechecked. Because these young people who are coming here, unfortunately, might be just a handful of people who are creating these problems for the rest of the young people and the rest of the country. And unfortunately, once Papua New Guinea name is, has got a bad reputation, then the Australian government or the farmers will have to think twice before they engage them.
What do you think of this seasonal work that Australia and New Zealand have been offering to Pacific Islanders?
It's a great, great program to both countries that are a host country, as well as the country like Papua New Guinea and other Pacific Islanders working in both host countries, New Zealand and Australia. And our government and our young people should really grab it with open arms and take on board and respect the country that is hosting them and respect the people they're working with, respect the people of this country, and just try and adapt and adjust to the rules and the lifestyle that is available here, because it's a great, great opportunity. And as a matter of fact, I've tried to do that right at the beginning of this seasonal work, but it never came through because, unlike other Pacific Islanders, I'll tell you now, Solomon Island brings in 50 to 100 people in just one town I know of. Fijians bring 50, 60, 100 people in one town alone. I don't know, you know, other cities like Brisbane, Melbourne, every state has this seasonal work. And yet, you have other Pacific Islanders who are coming in hundreds, I mean hundreds, to these three towns now. We don't bring in that many compared to them. I don't know what the reason is. It breaks my heart because I'm a grandmother, I'm a mother, I'm a teacher, educator, and I love my country, I love my young people. I want to help and support this program, but it's not working.
Before, you said that such incidences like this bring a bad name to not just the people involved, but the whole country. So what would you like to see done from the PNG end and also here in Australia?
Okay, number one, the selection criteria. Number two, how is the system working? And who is involved and how is it involved? I don't know. I have no idea. So I don't like to point fingers. But I think that process needs to be looked at very closely. So is the selection criteria strict enough? There has to be an orientation done in Papua New Guinea before they get on the plane. And after they come here, there has to be an orientation done here by Australians, because Papua New Guineans don't exactly know 100% of what goes on here. I think we all would like to see that. And it has to be a fair distribution of workers from every province. And it cannot be dominated by certain provinces. Every province has to be given that opportunity.
So you don't think there is enough awareness about Australia's strict laws on sexual harassment and gender-based violence?
I don't think there is enough awareness done on the regulations. You know, like when my students come from university, I talk to them about sexual harassment, which is very, very, very strict in Australia. Domestic violence, which is very, very strict in Australia. You know, I could have put somebody in prison, but I didn't. Because I'm a pastoral care provider, I took him under my wings and kept him until he finished his uni studies before I sent him home. So really, you can talk to them, but it's not the same as somebody who lives here, knows the rules and regulations, the toughness and the strictness of Australian rules. You know, you can't get away with just touching one woman's bum, which is very common in Papua New Guinea and other islands. We just think it's fine. Well, you can't do that here. You'll be taken to court. So there's not enough awareness or education done in our countries before they come to Australia or New Zealand. And they just take it as fun. Papua New Guineans take these kind of things as fun because it happens in Papua New Guinea and they get away with it. They think they can get away with it here. And you don't. You can go to jail or get deported.
And that is Sawaniongomeni, a PNG community leader in Queensland, speaking with Caroline Terriman. Now back to the Solomon Islands. They've been grappling with a deadly problem that has been 8 decades in the making. The country is littered with unexploded bombs, mortars and other ammunition. It's left behind by American and Japanese forces after the ferocious battles to control the island chain during World War II. As foreign correspondent Stephanie March reports from Honiara, while Japan and the Allies are putting some effort towards cleaning up the mess, some locals say it's not nearly enough.
In a neighbourhood in West Honiara, three officers from the Solomon Islands Police Bomb Squad walk through long grass down a steep hill. They're responding to a report someone's found a bomb in their front yard. After examining an object lying in the grass, Constable Lawrence Waninau carefully picks it up.
So what did you find?
It's a Japanese 37mm projectile.
Mm-hmm.
It's dangerous for the community here, so because once the fire is heated up, then it will go off. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Local Alan Bialasi says it was found by a child, and it's not the first time.
They found small hand grenades, quite a few actually.
The officers head to another four locations in Honiara. By the end of the day, they've recovered more than 100 projectiles, shells and mortars from people's gardens and a construction site. This is extremely common. Since 2011, the Solomon Islands Police have found nearly 50,000 unexploded ordnance, known as UXOs, left over from World War II. They range from small ammunition to a 2,000-pound bomb. Clifford Tanuki is the bomb squad's acting director.
Some of the ordnances, they have some very sensitive elements within the bomb, which is really sensitive to movement. So the moment you touch it, it just explodes. For the past 10 years, about 13 people have been killed.
So for a small population, it is a high number.
Yeah, it's quite concerning.
One more firewood or a couple more firewoods in?
Maevelyn Pitanoi is making scones in her kitchen on the Honiara waterfront. 3 years ago, she was cooking on a traditional fire pit when a US shell buried underground exploded, killing her two friends.
I threw in the cabbage and I was stirring it. And just when I was serving it into the bowl that they were holding on to, then the thing exploded. I didn't hear the explosion. I heard the hissing sound. And then I realized that something is happening to us. I saw my left hand all hanging, you know, the skin and the flesh were all hanging right to my ribs. And then I realized I'm in big trouble.
She's been left with severe injuries to her arms, hands, legs and abdomen. Japan and the US have provided some funding and resources to try to clean up these remnants of war. But people like Maevelyn get no support, and she worries that not enough is being done to help survivors and educate others of the risks of living with UXOs.
In other places, there is support. And in the Solomons, there is no support. It's really frustrating to me, and emotionally it affects me.
Do you think that the US and Japan and the Allies should do more?
Yes. Sometimes I want to blame the Allies for the war. And had it not for them, I wouldn't be having these issues. But it's because of what they came with and what they leave behind that caused some of us to have these injuries and lost lives.
And that's Solomon Island survivor Maevelyn Pitanoi, ending that report by Stephanie March.
Join me, Natasha Metten, for Sisters Let's Talk, I'll be interviewing incredible guests and discussing issues that are in the hearts and minds of Pacific women.
She was just going on to 19 when she had a baby. I instantly blamed myself.
I had to take pictures of some pollution and all that, and I was attacked on board out at sea.
Tune in to Sisters Let's Talk, Thursday mornings at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. We head to Samoa, where there have been weeks of confusion after the government made changes to electoral laws affecting citizens living overseas. Initially, there was speculation the changes would allow the members of the diaspora to vote in the next general election. But it's a huge change, given more Samoans live overseas than in Samoa. But the government is stressing citizens living abroad will only be able to register to vote online. They will still have to come back to Samoa to physically cast their vote. Despite attempts at clarification, there's still plenty of confusion, as Adele Fruin reports from Apia.
Miracle Lungi runs a local store near the Apia Airport, selling vegetables. She sees a lot of people come and go from Samoa, and she supports moves to give those living overseas a better chance to vote.
A lot of people say that our Samoan people living abroad do not have a right to vote, but they forget that these people they are talking about are real Samoans in the flesh and blood. They too are citizens here.
Despite heated debate last month, Samoa's government passed its electoral amendment bill. It says the bill will help with issues around voter re-registration and electoral roll maintenance in advance of the 2026 general elections. The amendments, it says, will remove the names of voters who have moved abroad permanently or are inactive. But in the community, confusion remains.
I believe that a lot of our people do not understand the new changes that have been passed.
Tavi Talave, an Apia local, says he's one of them.
As for myself, I don't really understand the new changes. Some say that overseas Samoans can now vote, while others say that it's just for registration.
The country's Minister for the Electoral Commission has since responded, clarifying in Parliament that only Samoan citizens can register to vote online, and they still have to return home for the 2026 election.
When people living overseas register online, they are still required to travel to Samoa for biometrics and further certification of residence before they are placed in the most appropriate constituency's electoral roll.
He also says that another requirement is proof of residence by a church minister or village mayor. However, Samoans living overseas say misinformation is still being spread online. And Nulua Fa'afa, a Samoan citizen living in New Zealand, says the government should look at making the voting system in Samoa easier first.
Why are we trying to reach people living far away, like New Zealand? What about our people in Samoa?
Legal expert Fuimaono Dylan Asafo says there is still confusion in community, and some of it is being spread by opposition MPs.
There are still very much legal requirements in place to ensure that only Samoan citizens who actually reside in Samoa can vote. And the recent law changes that Parliament passed this past month do not alter or remove these requirements. It's really important that all Samoans, including opposition MPs, actually take the time to read the law that was passed and understand the changes that have been made.
Most Pacific nations bar. Fiji requires its citizens to be in the country to vote. Solomon Islands goes to the polls next week. It requires its citizens to travel to its regional constituencies to vote. And Samoa allowing those living abroad to register online will be a first for the country. And Mr. Fuimaono says the government should give an opportunity to Samoans to voice their concerns about these changes before passing them.
I think this controversy has shown that the government needs to be a lot more democratic and transparent around this issue of overseas registration and voting rights, and that they must invest in greater consultation efforts and public education initiatives moving forward.
And that's legal expert Fuimaono Dylan Asafo, ending that report from Adele Fruin in Apia. Well, cutting-edge laser technology has allowed archaeologists to uncover remnants of an ancient city in Tonga. Aerial scanners used to map archaeological sites on Tongatapu has spotted close to 10,000 mounds that were once residences long ago. PhD scholar at Australian National University, Canberra, Philip Parton, told Kyle Evans the findings prove that urbanisation existed in Tonga hundreds of years earlier than originally thought.
So the laser scanner is bolted to the bottom of an aeroplane that flies long lines up and down, similar to mowing the grass. The useful thing for us as archaeologists from this laser scanner is that we can see the ground underneath the vegetation, and you see a variety of things. You see bumps in the form of these mounds, you see walls, fortifications, things like that, and you also see bumps in the ground, worn out roads that had been sort of created depressions by people walking on them for 3,000 years, and so it's a fantastic data set to be able to use here in the Pacific.
That allowed you to be able to conclude that, well, urbanisation, I should say, had taken place, what, 700 years before you thought it originally had?
Yeah, we went out and did some archaeological survey involving the old-fashioned digging a hole in the ground. And, yeah, when we'd done that, we'd extracted charcoal samples that we could measure the radiocarbon content, and that's what we were using to then, to our surprise, finding that they're a couple of hundred years earlier than what people had previously considered that they were being built.
I read in the press release as well that urbanisation, you were able to discover that urbanisation was actually an indigenous innovation. Did the previous research state otherwise, did it?
Literature from other disciplines put cities down as, you know, being sort of colonial artefacts, like European traders established settlements that they based themselves out of, and because European shipping was coming in, you know, they became some of the cities. And while I'm sure that's the case for a lot of places in the Pacific, the important thing for this research shows that while that may have happened in some places, there actually is a local Pacific tradition of creating and living in this way.
So now that you have this technology, is that going to pave the way for future projects throughout the Pacific to potentially uncover some, you know, similar discoveries?
Absolutely. Other research that uses this technology, while not using the same urbanisation lens to talk about these things, describes really similar sorts of arrangements of space. I'm sure that should my colleagues choose to pursue that, you know, this won't be the only example of a city to be found in the Pacific. I'm sure there's plenty waiting for us.
And now that you've got this information, what do you plan to do with it? Well, this obviously, it's probably going to help you add to your information in terms of understanding of Pacific societies, but will you be able to give this to people within Tonga and add to their history in some way?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one of the guys who we're working with, so a lot of these, all these land parcels that these mounds are constructed on, they all have names and stories attached to them, and he was sort of piggybacking off of our research to build his own kind of research on what the names were and who lived there, etc. So it's really cool.
Fascinating stuff there. That was PhD scholar at ANU Canberra, Philip Parton, speaking to reporter Carl Evans. While for many Pasifika people growing up in the diaspora, language and identity has been lost due to many factors, including colonisation. And now that generation is being labelled as plastic. And what often comes with that is regret, shame, and sometimes an unwillingness to embrace one's heritage. And that's the story of our following guest, who received negative online shame. But it led the director, producer, Chelsea Cuthis-Munro, to create her very first short film, The Vaka That Waited, Responding to My Call Home. Now, she joins us this morning to share her experiences. With that, I say, kia ora, Chelsea, welcome to the show.
Kia ora, nā morena, Agnes. Thank you so much for having me this morning.
Absolutely. Look, firstly, congratulations on the soon-to-be-released short film. I do just want to take us back, probably before we get into the good parts, want to take us through sort of the bad parts where, you know, that moment around the negative online shame that you received. Do you mind sharing what actually happened?
Of course. So first and foremost, I think growing up, I kind of adopted the label of being plastic. I couldn't speak the reo. I was very fair-skinned, very papa'a looking and around the culture much. So I guess going into Pacific Media Network, working there has been incredible. I got asked to do an online Cook Island piece to celebrate Cook Island's Language Week in 2019. And so when I got that, I was very excited. We did the filming. And I asked, you know, for a few words to use from the Cook Island team. And so I was really confident in filming. It was a really fun process. And so the video went up. I was really proud of it, actually, when the video first came up. And then all the comments started coming through from our Cook Islands community, which was very, very harmful, very hurtful. Tell this white girl to leave our culture alone. What a shame. Whose family is she from? She's not from my family. A lot of that kind of tone and a lot of the comments, which, again, just reaffirmed that negative self-belief I had about myself in terms of claiming Cook Island's heritage and culture. So that's how it all started, very painful. But I guess looking back in hindsight, I'm grateful for that because that was the catalyst, that was the moment for me to be like, okay, I can cry about it. This is what's happening. I do feel disconnected from my culture. What can I do about it?
But I do have to ask, though, Chelsea, this would have taken you through an emotional roller coaster of some sorts. How was it that you were able to deal with it, with all that negativity?
Well, I think first and foremost, I had my moment where I was just like, I'm never doing anything for my culture again. If this is how I'm going to be received by my people, like, I don't want anything to do with that. So I had those kind of feelings first, and then I got over myself, and then I was like, okay, what can we do? How can I heal this? Because the funny thing with the criticism, I mean, as hurtful and as painful, the way that it was said was, I don't agree with, but deep under there somewhere, there was a sense of pride for our culture from our people. So just communicating that, I guess they could have done that a little bit better. But I was like, you know, to be honest, like, I don't know much about my culture. I don't know much about my genealogy, my family line. And so I came out and I was like, every single year for Cook Island Language Week from here on out, I want to create an initiative to draw me back to my Cook Islands heritage. And this has been the biggest one yet.
So why a short film, though, then? I mean, what were you hoping, or what are you hoping to achieve through this short film?
Yeah, so I'm a very passionate storyteller. I love storytelling, especially as an Indigenous woman. I film and visual storytelling is so powerful. And I think, you know, stepping out to do this, I want it to be a mirror reflection of our people. I want them to see themselves throughout the documentary, whether that's through my Nana's story, who's a well-seasoned, you know, Cook Islander who can speak bilingual English and Te Reo Māori Tuku Ki Arani. And then those that are maybe in my generation, second generation New Zealand-born Cook Islanders that are kind of feeling, okay, I can see where I come from, but why is there this disconnect and why am I where I am now? So I had to contextualize that by looking back into, again, my genealogy, my Cook Islands history, and then using that as a map to draw on to navigate a future path and carve out a future path for all those that have felt inadequacy and unworthiness around claiming themselves as a Pasifika, as a Cook Islander.
And I do have to ask, you know, I said in the intro, and you've also mentioned it, that term plastic, used a lot, right, for those who don't know the language. I mean, how then can you encourage those to positively counter that in this day and age?
Well, I think first and foremost, it's an oppressive, harmful language right there. So not only having people tell you that you're plastic, I noticed I begin to adopt that terminology. So I would come out and I'd say, oh, you know, I'm a plastic, I don't know. And I noticed with so many of our second and first generation New Zealand-born Pasifika people, a lot of the time we just run with it. Okay, I'm plastic, it makes sense, let's go with it. So now when I'm talking to people, and a lot of them are Cook Islanders as well, statistically across board, we are at the bottom when it comes to passing down the language and retaining a lot of that culture. So statistically it's backed, but I can't stand it now. So when someone, you know, comes out and they're like, oh, you know, I don't know anything about my culture, like, I'm plastic. No, no, no. Language is powerful. And so actually being able to correct that in real time because you're aware of it now and you're aware of the labels and how harmful they can be, I think has been really, really eye-opening and healing, not only for myself and my family, but a lot of my generation as well.
Beautiful to hear, Charles. If you're just tuning in, we're speaking to Cook Islander director, producer Chelsea Cuthers-Munro on her short film, The Vaka That Waited, Responding to My Call Home. Process of the filming, you obviously went back home to the islands, right? How was that?
The process I absolutely loved. I found my answers in the process. I honestly thought starting this journey, my answer would be found when I finally learned fluent Te Reo Māori Kiarani. I found very, very quickly that that wasn't the case. I started this project about 3 years ago. It's been in the works for a while, and I think stepping out, I was very naive to the amount of energy and resources and time that it would take to get it to where it is today. So that was really beautiful. But like I said, I found healing and going back to my homeland, knowing when to sit and to listen, to receive, and then knowing when to stand in my power and challenge and use my voice. So I think that was amazing, going back to my Nana's house, of course, and just hearing the history and stories of my personal family has been healing as well, learning and contextualizing where I fit in on my family genealogy to understand my past, because I think that's a big part of knowing how to navigate forward. You have to look back and you have to make peace with your past. You have to shine a light on where you've come from so you kind of know where to go. So the whole journey has been so empowering. I've found my voice. I've found my sense of belonging. And I only noticed that through post-production, about a month ago. I was like, man, I can stand in a room full of Cook Islanders and know I belong. I deserve to be there, even though I might not speak the language. It's innately in me because I akapapa, because it's in my blood. It's there.
Wow. I know, of course, you are also an amazing mum. I'm wondering, what's the journey been like for your two beautiful kids, obviously Mariah and Romy? I mean, you know, that whole thing of passing on the baton.
Oh, don't make me cry. It's too early in the morning to cry. It has been... this whole thing has been my gift back to them. I think as a mum, my hope for the future is that they never have to struggle with that feeling of identity. And for me, the vaka symbolizes my culture, which was there waiting for me to explore. However, I like as I mentioned earlier, I battled with these feelings of unworthiness. But they've got their own vakas, and they're more multicultural. They're Niuean, they're Samoan, Tongan. They're a whole fruit salad, so they've got multiple vakas waiting there, which I know can be very overwhelming at times to explore all the different parts in themselves. But I never want them to feel like they have to prove themselves to anybody, and not only culturally, but in any capacity, that they inherently know that when they're ready to sail their vaka, mum's going to be there and I'm going to support them all the way.
Beautiful. You weren't meant to make me cry too, also, Chelsea. Goodness. I have to ask, yeah, and I know you alluded to it a little bit, but yes, as a Kuki Airani woman in the diaspora, again, what has the journey taught you in terms of reclaiming the language? Like, what has been, have you been taking classes at all, or how is it being able to finally learn the reo?
I think that's a really great question. I talked earlier, in a previous interview about capacity for me. I was just going through quite a bit, as we do in life, Agnes, in the past couple of years. So I felt like I didn't have the, it takes a lot of energy to explore and to really be switched on in that zone. So only in the beginning of this year, I felt like I had the capacity to finish this documentary, actually. But through that, I definitely do have a passion to actually create modules that are more accessible for people. I know as a busy mum, a lot of times we see 6 to 8 week blocks once a year from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. at night in the city, right? For me, I can't commit to that because, again, I'm a mum, I'm quite limited. So my goal is actually to work alongside some of our amazing Cook Island mamas and papas to really document and archive and create modules that are accessible, that are free for everybody to learn whenever they want to and to tap into. So to answer your story, no, I haven't taken any classes, but I do see a gap in the market, so to speak, about what we can do to provide more accessibility to resources from our people.
Beautiful. And of course, I know the main question that people will probably be wanting to know is details on the premiere. I know you are there in Aotearoa, but even for those overseas, could they possibly view the short film?
Yes, so Māngere Arts Centre, tomorrow night actually, we have our first premiere viewing. We have a panel there as well, so it's going to be incredible. But I've had people ask from, it's been quite overwhelming actually, from America, from Australia, from the Cook Islands themselves, how can we access this? And I'm like, to be honest, I didn't think that far ahead. I was just thinking, put it on YouTube and to kind of have this short documentary, but there's a demand for it. So I'm like, might have to talk with Netflix or Manifesting right now to find a platform that's accessible for everyone all over the world. So, we are working on that at the moment with my production team of how we can actually get it out there, put it on a platform that's accessible for everyone wanting to watch it.
Exciting. And look, I do have to ask, final words, because this is the film that is going to showcase your life. But to those who may be struggling to identify with their culture, what would you say?
If you are kapapa, that's enough to start your journey. That's all you need. If it's in your blood, you already have permission to start exploring. And a lot of the times I found that the answers I was looking for on the outside were already within myself. And so to have grace with yourself on your journey and those around you.
That's beautiful. It has been very encouraging to hear your journey, and I have seen parts of your life back home, and I do really appreciate, you know, what you are doing for all our Pacifica people, Polynesia, Micronesia, Melanesia. You are doing your thing, Chelsea, and I'm just so very proud of you.
Well, thank you, sis. I'm proud of you too. Look at where you are. It's amazing to see you doing your thing.
I appreciate it. And all the best. All the best for the premiere tomorrow. I know our people will be coming through to support you. So thank you again for joining us this morning. Me taki ma'ata.
Me taki.
No worries. That, of course, is director-producer of the short film The Vaka That Waited, Chelsea Cuthers-Munro, here on Pacific Beat.
Want to immerse yourself in sport and stories of athletes from across the Pacific? Well, join me, Bobby McCumber, alongside some of the most talented journalists and sports commentators from across the region for Fresh Off the Field. Each week, we'll bring you interviews with Pacific athletes leaving their mark on the international stage and those aspiring to do the same. From cricket to netball, athletics to rugby, and everything in between.
Fresh Off the Field, Thursday afternoon at 4 PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Want all the latest Pacific news, sports and entertainment delivered in your inbox every Thursday? ABC Pacific have launched a free weekly newsletter with exclusive content from across the Pacific by your favourite ABC presenters. Be the first to know about upcoming events and competitions in your area, plus much more, absolutely free and direct to you. It's easy to sign up. Just go to abc.net.au/Pacific and enter your email to join today.
And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. I'll be back next week, 6 a.m. PNG time, but our show will view again at 5 p.m. PNG time this afternoon. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia. Your news is next. Coming up after that, it's Nisha Daily. I'm Aggie Dupol, and this is Pacific Beat.